Right, I thought tonight I'd talk about my favourite subject, the Arahant. Strange word, Arahant. What does Arahant mean? Arahant is a Pali word. The most literal definition would be perfected one. Essentially, it's somebody who's completed their training, the Buddhist training. The Arahant is somebody who has, in the most wonderful way, let go of all craving for life to be different than it is. They have the most incredible intuitive understanding of the way life really is. That understanding has been wrought out of a tremendous struggle to come to understanding. It's something that they've chosen to do. And it all resolves in a beautiful moment when the realization of the way life really is arises for them. It's quite a mystical experience in a way. In another way, it's incredibly ordinary and quite obvious. The Arahant has realized the way life really is. And how is life really? Life is non-separate. There are no separate things. The enlightened being has realized that all forms are empty of any intrinsic reality. All forms, whether physical or mental. They therefore have no belief in any things. Not having any belief in any things, there is nothing to attach to, and there is no one to do the attaching. As a consequence, there is complete and absolute mental freedom. There is no mental pollution in an Arahant. There is no fear, no passion, no anger, no lust, no conceit, no deceit. They're completely free. But this moment, you know, it's so difficult to put across, this moment of this realization. I came across, somebody once actually told me that Frédéric Chopin, the composer, when he was asked where his inspiration for his music came from, he said, "It comes all of a piece." There is just a timeless moment where the whole piece that he subsequently writes comes to him, all of a piece. And what he then subsequently does is try to describe what it is that he's seen, or whatever it is that he's intuited. Mozart said something similar. He said that it was as if he had seen in the mind's eye a beautiful face, the face of a young child, and his music was an attempt to describe what he saw, which I think is really beautiful. And for the Arahant, it's very, very similar in that there is this one timeless moment of seeing the way life really is. Subsequent to that, they try to describe it, and they come within the bounds of time and space and the unsatisfactory world of duality, and they find that their descriptions never quite match up to that wonderful realization. And indeed, one of the most accurate descriptions is to say all forms are empty of any intrinsic reality. In the Parinibbana Sutta, the Buddha is asked, what are the factors that go to ensure a society's well-being and prosperity? And the Buddha lists a whole raft of factors that go to ensure a society's happiness and prosperity. One of the factors that he enumerates is reverence and honour given to Arahants, by the members of that society. If a society reveres and honours its Arahants, it will be happy, peaceful and prosperous. What do you think? Does our culture revere and honour its Arahants? As you know, we've recently been started to put videos on YouTube. You'll all be delighted to hear, I'm sure delighted to hear, that the first video we put up has passed the 1,000 hits mark. It did recently. I looked at YouTube recently and it had its the videos that had the biggest hits for 2009. The winner was a Miss S. Boyle of Scotland. 120 million hits. Oh, for a penny for every hit. We'd have £10. So, does society in general revere and honour its Arahants? No, not really. It reveres sports stars. Somebody was telling us that recently there's been sports personality awards handed out. And everyone honours sportsmen, they honour pop stars, they give them knighthoods, on and on and on it goes. But recently somebody else was telling us of a rugby star who had been an immense hero for his country because he had scored the winning kick at the very end of a World Cup, and it was the fulfilment of his childhood ambitions. Yet within an hour of the victory, he was left alone in the dressing room, feeling empty inside. All forms are empty of any intrinsic reality, even winning the World Cup. There's a story that I remember, I don't know where it comes from, of a king sending a man from his kingdom on a mission to another kingdom. And the man goes on this mission and he finds 1,001 things to do in this other country. But he forgets the one thing the king sent him for. And then he has to return back to his own kingdom and go and see the king again. What does the king do? Well, hopefully he won't behead him, but he's going to send him back again. There's a tremendous compassion wells up in the enlightened mind because it sees that all forms are empty of any intrinsic reality. And yet it sees beings everywhere so hell-bent on trying to create and make that final happiness, to ensure through their efforts that they will find true happiness, only to find that every single time that they end up empty-handed. The Arahant has succeeded in the one true goal of this life, which has come to see its true nature. That's what, if you like, the king had sent that man on that journey to do. And every now and again, somebody decides that that is actually the true goal of this life. You will never get our culture to honour and revere Arahants, because there is so much craving and hatred. There are so much other things that people want to do first. The Arahant reflects life perfectly. They're a perfect reflection of the way life truly is. If somebody decides to revere and honour an Arahant, then they have this understanding that there is something very important to do with this precious human life. They want that same understanding. They want that same knowledge, that same realisation. In the end, it's the only thing that's going to set them free. So how do you become an Arahant? First, we need to recognise that we use the word Arahant in Buddhism Other ways will have different names for this same being. Enlightenment is not the sole province of any one way. There are many ways to find enlightenment, but it has to be said, in many people's experience, walking the Noble Eightfold Path is an extremely effective and direct way. There is a you can sum up the whole of the Noble Eightfold Path in a very simple instruction. Rest content in the moment, watching the arising and passing away of things. Now within that short statement, there is the whole of the Noble Eightfold Path. Rest content in the moment. Develop your sila, your ethics, and your ability to concentrate, so that you can rest content in the moment. Watch the arising and passing away of things. Develop the concentration so you can pay attention. Develop the wisdom by looking directly at the way life really is. An even more simple instruction than that, although it's slightly more terse, is stop ignoring. The whole of the Noble Eightfold Path is constructed to enable a student to finally reach the point where they're no longer grasping at life, they're no longer wanting life to be different, they're perfectly in the moment, they simply sit and observe, and the realization of non-separateness comes to them. So if it's such a simple instruction, why do we find it so blooming difficult? What kind of qualities do you need for success? Oh, I could have gone on at length about this. I decided on just a couple of qualities. Kassapa, Mahakassapa, was one of the Buddha's chief disciples. Kassapa first met the Buddha on the high road. As soon as Kassapa met the Buddha, he immediately prostrated full length on the ground and said, "The Lord is my teacher, I am his disciple. The Lord is my teacher, I am his disciple. The Lord is my teacher, I am his disciple." Now, hands on heart, how many people could meet a complete stranger and just go down like that and give complete surrender? Very few. Very few have that power. The Buddha said to Kassapa, "Kassapa, if anyone who does not know and see were to say to a disciple endowed with such sincerity as yourself, 'I know, I see,' his head would explode." Put this another way to get the point across that I'm trying to make. When I first arrived here at Sulkana, the House of Inner Tranquility, to begin my training, a meditator asked me what I was going to do. And I said, I would, to the best of my ability, do whatever I was told to do. A few years later, that same meditator reminded me of what I'd said. And he admitted that at that time, a shiver had run down his spine when I'd said it. But he said it wasn't a shiver of appreciative joy. It was a shiver of fear. Why fear? Because what I was suggesting was that the way to enlightenment was through surrender, through faith, through devotion, through being willing to accept and implement the instructions that were given. Now, to the ego, that is the most terrible threat. An egotistical mind needs to defend itself. And in defending itself, it makes itself invulnerable, closed, cold, brittle. It's fearful of losing its independence to some other being, some other thing, to the teacher. It's fearful that it will be ripped off in some way. And at Cassopa, who had this amazing surrender and faith and devotion and willingness to surrender to the Buddha like that, never having met him before, had such power of faith and devotion that it could make somebody's head explode. In essence, and I was talking to somebody just yesterday about this, the whole path could be summed up by learning to accept and implement the original instruction. And the original instruction is to rest content in the moment and watch things arising and passing away. And in a sense, you could say that the whole path is getting the meditator to the point where they can just do that. But faith and devotion are absolutely essential. But it's not a blind faith. It's not saying, well, handing over all responsibility to some guru and therefore I don't have to do anything more. It's not an abdication. You have the faith to undertake the training as instructed in order to find out whether or not it works. So it's not blind faith. What happens after you become an arahant? Unfortunately, it doesn't confer any mundane expertise whatsoever. And that came as quite a disappointment. But what you do learn from that is that the Buddha himself said that he lived by Dhamma. He lived by the teaching that he taught. So he talked the talk and walked the walk. As a consequence of that, he lived the mundane teaching, which meant that he had ease of living here and now. And if an arahant is... because there's a book in the library written by a chap, and bless him, he's clearly the realization has come to him. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I wouldn't like to hang out with him, let's put it like that. Because he doesn't have a mundane teaching. And he doesn't teach other people. He finds that very, very difficult. He finds people abrasive and difficult to get on with, because he doesn't maintain a mundane practice. So if the arahant is sensible, if he wants to get on with the world, then he or she will undertake a mundane teaching. But the point I'm making is that it doesn't enlightenment in that sense doesn't give you anything. It takes away craving. It takes away hatred, it takes away delusion. And there are many blessings that do come along, but it doesn't mean that you can play the trombone. In the same way, it doesn't mean that you can enter into fixed meditations, jhanas. If you want to do that, you have to learn to do it, just like you would if you wanted to learn to play the trumpet. One thing about the arahant is that the arahant is no longer trying to change the ever-changing world. The belief that you can save the world has been completely abandoned. After all, the world is a formed thing, and it is empty of any intrinsic reality. Now, I should back that up by saying that, of course, if the arahant is... has mundane wisdom, then he will live a life of loving kindness, of service, of generosity, of being a help to his fellow man. But the arahant understands that there is absolutely no point trying to save the world, because the world doesn't need saving. Let me try to explain that in another way. I've been asked a couple of times, how many arahants I believe there are in the world. And I have a very poetic answer that I give. One in a million. There's one arahant to every million people. But then when I started to consider world populations, it started to sound quite reasonable. That means there'd be about 65 arahants in Britain, about 1,000 or 1,500 arahants in India, the home of spirituality. Seems reasonable enough. And in total, about 6,500 arahants worldwide. Kind of nice. Obviously, I'm completely making it up. But the point I'm trying to make is this. The world is like it is because all the beings that come into it are caught up with craving, hatred, born of delusion. It is inevitable that we will have imbalance in the world, apparent imbalance in the world. Look at the ecological imbalance that we have currently. There isn't anything wrong inherently with fossil fuels, or even using fossil fuels. If it is that there's a problem with the climate caused by fossil fuels, it's actually caused by people's greed. It's people's greed that's the imbalancing factor. Now, the Arahant is free from all greed, free from all hatred. So the Arahant is not creating any imbalance in the world whatsoever. How many Arahants do you think are required to offset the insuperable greed and hatred in the world? Well, I set myself the task of working it out, and I came to 1 in a million. 1 Arahant for every 1 million people. That makes about 65 in Britain, 1,000 in India, 6,500 worldwide. We'll keep everything in balance. Life's perfect as it is. Everyone in the world is actually trying to find the cessation of suffering. Everyone is. They're doing it all kinds of ways. Some people are doing it by trying to become an Olympic sprinting champion. It's empty. Another person is trying to do it by taking over the world. It's empty. They'll try it, they'll find it doesn't work. But that's perfectly fine. As long as there are Arahants being created in order to keep the balance. Does an Arahant need to teach? Do you need to know that a person is an Arahant? An Arahant lives according to their preferences and their proclivities. They may prefer not to teach, in which case that's perfectly fine. They might not have the ability to teach, in which case that's perfectly fine. Their life circumstances may not allow them to teach at this time. That's perfectly fine. There are other ways of teaching. An Arahant, somebody who is free from all craving or hatred or delusion, has a natural attraction to them. If it is the case that all beings are actually looking for the cessation of suffering, and that, funnily enough, deep down everyone knows what enlightenment is or what Nibbana is, then there will be a deep, in many people, there will be a natural attraction towards somebody, even if I don't recognize it consciously, there will be an attraction towards people that are free from craving and hatred and suffering. So it is possible for the Arahant to teach just through their spontaneous being, and teach very well, in actual fact. Just simply because they live a life free from craving and hatred and wanting life to be different all the time. That is actually, in many ways, that is a better form of teaching. Because you don't have to get all this stuff over the top. You just get the direct thing. So an Arahant may teach or may not teach. There are other ways of going about things without formally being a teacher. What you should also understand about the Arahant is that understanding emptiness, understanding that all forms have no intrinsic reality, is they know that there's no such thing as an Arahant. They know there's no such thing as an enlightened being. They know that there's no such thing as a teacher. So if the Arahant teaches, they're just fulfilling a natural spontaneous role. There's nothing personally they want out of it. Sometimes the unenlightened being doesn't quite understand that. It is possible for a student to take umbrage with a teacher. It has been known. It's a little bit like throwing fine dust into an oncoming breeze, because whatever is projected at the teacher just comes straight back. It does happen. But the teacher knows, that the arahant knows, essentially, that it is just simply a role that's undertaken for the benefit of helping people along. Take Kassapa, Mahakassapa, that I mentioned a little earlier as an example. When he met the Buddha felt Kassapa's robes and remarked how soft they were, and compared them to the coarse hempen robes that the Buddha himself was wearing. Kassapa said, out of compassion, will you please swap robes with me so that you can have the soft robe and I'll have the coarse hempen robe. The Buddha agreed, but it is stated that in swapping his rough garments with the soft garments, what the Buddha was asking Kassapa to do was to undertake what are called in Buddhism the Dutanga practices, the austerities, things like living outside, things like wearing coarse dirt rags rather than beautifully made robes, only taking one meal a day, not having seconds, that sort of thing. Kassapa, in accepting the coarse hempen robe, accepted that role that the Buddha had asked of him. 2 weeks later, Kassapa was enlightened, but he maintained those Dutanga practices for the rest of his life. He had very few students, and yet he became what's known as the father of the Sangha, even though he didn't teach per se. He lived this austere, solitary life. Now, what I get out of that is the reason that Kassapa did it. He did it for the benefit of people that would come later. So the way he lived his life, you might say, what, he wasn't actually teaching, and yet he was. He was showing that it was possible to undertake these practices for specific reasons. He was ensuring that these Dutanga practices that the Buddha wanted to flourish were able to flourish. He was acting out of compassion, even though he wasn't specifically teaching. So doesn't it make sense then to revere and honour arahants if they know the way to the cessation of suffering, if they are a perfect reflection of the way life really is, if they're free from craving and hatred and delusion, and what at the heart everyone wants is to be free of craving and hatred and delusion and to be free of suffering? The Buddha said that an arahant is an insurpassable field of merit for the world. What does that mean? If you plant a seed in a field that's overgrown with weeds and it's full of stones, you wouldn't expect much yield. You wouldn't expect much to come back to you. If, however, that field is rich with nutrients, then to place a seed in that field will bring a wonderful return, a wonderful yield. Looking after arahants, catering for their material needs, is a wonderful, meritorious action. There was an occasion when a arahant developed a skin complaint. They found out that the skin complaint was due to dust mite poo, for want of a better word, and that's what was causing the irritation. One of his students went out and brought the arahant duvets, these sort of, I don't know what you call them, these anti-bacterial duvets and pillows and sheets and so forth. And the skin complaint was remedied. That meditator went on to become enlightened. Why? It wasn't the actual gift in itself. What did it say about the mental state of the giver, about what he revered and honoured and thought was most important in life? What was it that he wanted to care for? What was it that he wanted to keep going for his own benefit? It was the path to the deathless, which the Arahant understood. So it's looking after the Arahants is also a statement of intent. You can revere the Arahants of the past. There's a recollection of the Sangha that you can do. That generates tremendous faith and devotion in the Sangha. You can follow the teaching all the way from the Buddha to Ananda, who had that amazing retentive memory and was able to recite all the teachings that the Buddha gave. Kassapa, who ensured that the teaching was codified and set in stone, if you like, by forming the councils, bringing the lineage more up to date. You had a Thai Buddhist monk called Chalkun Pavana Koso, who became enlightened and taught a Western Buddhist monk called Kapaluwadu Bhikkhu. He taught Alan and Jackie James. So reflecting like that, you can see that the lineage of Arahants has come all the way down to us, still offering teaching of how to reach enlightenment, for that realization to arise. If someone practices that kind of recollection, that faith and devotion that Kassapa demonstrated becomes a power within that person. It brings diligence and a desire to practice. It's a wonderful practice to do. There's also revering and honouring present Arahants. And two people went to see Alan today to give him a gift on behalf of all the meditators. What's that if not revering and honouring and looking after the Arahants? So that's past and present. What about future Arahants? It's you lot. The Buddha said, he honours me best who practices my teaching the best. If, as a centre, we continue to revere and honour the Arahants, we will ensure the continued prosperity, peace and happiness of this centre. And in doing so, you may be maintaining the conditions that you need in order to finish the job, or continue the job. This centre has always thrived because it reveres the Arahants. It was actually formed by Arahants. It was created by Arahants. Don't think that every Buddhist centre that's around was based in such intrinsic understanding of the way life is. Not all Buddhist centres are the same. But this centre was made, created by Arahants. There's a few lines that I found in the Sutta Nipata. A Brahmin asks the Buddha, who is worthy to receive gifts? And this is what he replies. The wandering conqueror who has let sense pleasures go has seen where birth and death end. In the fullness of extinguishing, he is cool like a lake. He is the one thus gone and worthy of offerings. He has crossed the stream. The mind is composed. In the perfection of knowledge, he has realized the way things are. He is in his last body, and the passions are burnt out. The one thus gone is is worthy of offerings. There is nothing in him that can lead to bewilderment. Causes of ignorance are gone. There are none whatsoever. He perceives with insight all phenomena. He bears his last body. Full enlightenment is reached, ultimate and blissful, and purification has taken place. The one thus gone is worthy of offerings. Thank you very much.